Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Today's annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast in Boston highlighted some recent electoral changes and what they might suggest about King's vision for a more equitable society. Freshman Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley thanked Dr. King and his wife, Coretta Scott King, for their influence on the civil rights movement.
We are shaking the table in the corridors of power at the policy and decision-making tables, assuming our rightful place as the preservers of democracy, as the truth tellers and the justice seekers. So yes, thank you, Martin, and thank you, Coretta.
Joining us to talk more about this is WBUR reporter Callum Borchers, who was at the breakfast. Hi there, Cal.
Hey there, Deb.
So Boston Police Commissioner William Gross was also among those who spoke today, and he emphasized this theme of change in political representation since King's Day. Let's listen to a bit of what Commissioner Gross said.
Look at the face of politics in Boston, where you have six women of color on Boston City Council. Look at the face of politics, both state and locally.
So, Callum, what else did we hear from the commissioner and others today?
Well, you know, he did talk a little bit about himself, Deb. He is, after all, the first black police commissioner in Boston. He's the 42nd commissioner overall, so he quipped that he shares that number with another pioneer. That would be Jackie Robinson, of course. But really, he talked a lot about voting. You know, he sort of emphasized that the reason you're seeing these changes, the half dozen women of color on the Boston City Council, Ayanna Pressley in Congress, even him in the more indirect way as the commissioner of Boston, is because people are speaking and they're turning out to vote.
So let's hear a little bit more of what Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley said. She also thanked her mother, Sandy Pressley, today.
It's black women like Sandy Pressley and Coretta Scott King that nursed babies, that oiled scalps, that moisturized elbows and knees, that cooked, that fed, that prayed, that led, that were architects of movements all the way on today to Black Lives Matter. Black women, we are reclaiming our time.
So really what Pressley was getting at there was kind of putting her win in November in the context of decades and even longer of, in her view, black women being relegated to supporting roles. This is why I think she wanted to pay special tribute to Coretta Scott King. She was there saying, look, yes, here we're at the MLK breakfast. We're here to honor him, but he wouldn't have accomplished what he did without her by his side. And now here I am as the first black woman from Massachusetts in Congress.
Hmm. You know, Senators Markey and Elizabeth Warren were also in attendance today, both commenting on the government shutdown. Let's listen to a little bit of Senator Markey.
Even at 90 years old, you just know Dr. King would have been standing alongside the unpaid federal government workers just as he stood with the sanitation workers in Memphis the night before he died.
So, Callum, how much was the current political situation mentioned during the breakfast today, would you say?
You know, it really depended on the speaker. So Pressley made a deliberate effort to not talk about the president. Mm. In fact, one of her first remarks when she got up was basically to say, you know, the oppressor, as she referred to him, without naming him, gets enough oxygen, enough attention, so let's not give him any more. But Markey and Elizabeth Warren went after him hard. Of course, Warren is running for president, or at least exploring that possibility, mm-hmm. very much in campaign mode, however. And we really saw some of that today. This was a little bit of what Elizabeth Warren said today that sort of fit into the stump speech that we've heard already from her in Iowa, New Hampshire, and elsewhere.
Race matters. Call it out and fight back. The path to economic security is steep and rocky for millions of working people in America, and it is steeper and rockier for black and brown Americans.
And so what Warren really added there was to say, if we want to carry on Dr. King's legacy, it's our job to call out that type of imbalance.
Now, we heard today that the Boston Foundation and Boston University have joined together and they're going to donate $750,000 for efforts to memorialize Dr. King and his wife here in Boston. What do you know about that?
Right. So those are the latest additions to what is a $12 million effort to build a memorial to the Kings, both of them, on Boston Common. And we got an update from Paul English, the Kayak founder who is helping to organize that today, said they're about halfway to meeting that goal. So that was big news. And, of course, the Kings have a rich history in Boston. Dr. King studied theology here at Boston University, just up the street. He met Coretta Scott here in Boston. And as Paul English noted in his remarks at the breakfast this morning, there's a local filmmaker working on a documentary about that love story, how the two of them met right here in Boston.
All right. WBUR Bostonomics reporter Callum Borchers, thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
And while each year we reflect on King's legacy in the United States, Dr. King also had a substantial international impact. While he was provoking some intense animosity in the U.S., our next guest says Dr. King was sometimes treated like a celebrity overseas. Jason Sokol is professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and author of the book titled The Heavens Might Crack: The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King, Jr. And he joined us to talk about the inverse relationship between King's global popularity and his perception at home.
By the end of King's life, 1967 and 1968, many white Americans had sort of turned against him. And that was because King had grown increasingly radical. Namely, he had delivered this famous address critiquing the Vietnam War. That was in Riverside Church in New York City in 1967. And King really critiqued all of American society in that address. And in turn, many Americans from President Johnson on down began to think of King as more of a rabble-rouser and an agitator. The interesting thing is that abroad, King's comments about Vietnam were the kind of thing that many people overseas embraced. I mean, many people from Europe to Africa and Asia viewed the U.S.'s waging of the Vietnam War as basically a brutal imperialist folly. And here was King calling it that.
Right, right. We actually have a clip from that speech in 1967 in New York. Let's listen.
It is curious that the Americans who calculate so carefully on the possibilities of military victory do not realize that in the process they're incurring deep psychological and political defeat. The image of America will never again be the image of revolution, freedom, and democracy, but the image of violence and militarism, unquote. If we continue, there will be no doubt in my mind and in the mind of the world that we have no honorable intentions in Vietnam.
That was the speech that really rose his profile internationally, right?
Right. I mean, he's talking about what the image of America was overseas. And for instance, you know, these people abroad, when King critiqued U.S. policy, they really felt that he was speaking for them. As you say, you know, this is the kind of thing that turned many Americans against him. I mean, even sort of mainstream white liberals who had been supportive of King during his crusades in the South and Birmingham and Selma. Well, now he was deploring the U.S. as a whole, and he was also moving more radically on what he was saying about income inequality.
Mm. You know, even before that speech, you write in your book about a visit, King's visit to Germany in September of 1964, and how he was treated there, you say, like an international rock star. What happened there?
This visit to Berlin in 1964, part of what was fascinating is that people in West Berlin and in East Berlin both greeted King like a champion. King arrived in West Germany. He gave an address in an open-air stadium to thousands of Germans, and he was basically talking about the civil rights movement and about struggles for freedom in the West. And then he crossed over into the East that night, and he was also greeted like like an international champion there as well.
And he was allowed in.
He was allowed in. There's a funny story where he got to Checkpoint Charlie, and he had in fact, forgot his passport. They asked for any kind of an identification. He showed his American Express card, and they let him through. But, you know, the guards didn't let him through just on their own accord. The East German government had indeed decided that it would be beneficial for King to come to East Berlin, and that was because East German leaders, like many communist leaders, were interested in anything that would show America in a bad light. So King was there to highlight, you know, the great blot on the United States, and that blot was the continuation of racial injustice and racial inequality.
But of course, the reason he's drawing these crowds is they're inspired by his message of rebellion.
Right. So thousands of people packed into this church in East Berlin to hear King speak because his address about freedom and the black freedom struggle, and he ended it on the refrain of "Let my people go." That kind of address really resonated with the ordinary East Berliners who saw themselves being oppressed and repressed by that regime.
Now, shortly after that, he wins the Nobel Peace Prize. And we have a clip of his acceptance speech that I want to play. And in this clip, King is questioning why the prize was given to someone who's leading a movement that hasn't won peace. Let's listen.
Civilization and violence are antithetical concepts. Negroes of the United States, following the people of India, have demonstrated that nonviolence is not sterile passivity, but a powerful moral force which makes for social transformation. Sooner or later, all the peoples of the world will have to discover a way to live together in peace and thereby transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of brotherhood.
What would you say, if you could sum it up, because I'm sure it's complicated, but what was the effect of winning the Nobel Peace Prize, both domestically and internationally, for King?
Yeah, well, I think it was really important to him to understand that he had allies all around the world. So often, throughout his career, if King would feel the vitriol in the U.S. really boiling, he sometimes took trips abroad because he learned that he could breathe there, you know, that he wasn't he wasn't sort of hunted down each day and each moment. He wasn't a target of white segregationists. He wasn't a target of the FBI. So when he went abroad, he did find something of a safe haven.
Right. And you write in the book about how, you know, he goes to accept the Nobel Prize, and it's this great celebration. And then he comes back, and folks in Atlanta have to, you know, be almost forced to attend a dinner for him and do it begrudgingly so they don't look bad, really. So can you explain that a little bit?
That's right. He was given the Nobel Peace Prize, and so a few leading white liberals in Atlanta, Ralph McGill, who was the publisher of the Atlanta Constitution, and a couple of religious leaders, decided that they wanted his hometown of Atlanta to honor King with a banquet. And they sent out telegrams asking for donations and support, and very few of Atlanta's leading white businessmen were interested in helping out. They saw King basically as an agitator and somebody who was stirring up trouble. And so you had this this great dissonance, this person who's just been recognized with one of the greatest global awards, and then in his hometown it took every bit of cajoling to finally get a banquet for him. And indeed, the banquet only took place after New York Times and NBC News wrote and aired these spots publicizing the fact that white Atlanta was not interested in honoring King. Well, finally, those leading businessmen in Atlanta were basically shamed into supporting that kind of banquet. And indeed, it finally happened, but only after great toil.
Do you think that part of the difference between the way King was received in the U.S. and internationally is because you could admire him and his courage from afar, because really it's not threatening your way of life at all or anything that's happening to you personally? I mean, is that part of it?
That's got to be part of it, yeah. I mean, when King was talking about revolutionizing a society or transforming a nation, he was usually talking about transforming the United States.
Right.
So those kinds of words and actions of his were indeed most threatening to whites in the United States, whereas often people around the world could cheer on King basically from the sidelines, mm-hmm. and rest assured that he wasn't attempting to overturn their society. Although there were a few exceptions to that. I mean, for instance, the South African government didn't allow King to speak in South Africa because they were worried about the effect that he might have on people there. So I think he did actually have a tangible effect in some places, even though that general dynamic is definitely true.
Can he be compared with Nelson Mandela or Gandhi? I mean, what do you say when folks make those comparisons?
I'd say, oh, of course. I mean, this was one of the things that I really learned through doing the research and the writing of this book. I mean, I, like most Americans, had initially viewed King as basically an American leader and a civil rights leader, and I hadn't appreciated his global reach and the fact that he was seen as a hero by so many people across the globe, people who were waging struggles, anti-racist struggles or anti-imperialist struggles, many places, the countries of Africa. For instance, in India, he was hailed as indeed the heir to Gandhi. So you mentioned Gandhi, and people in India saw that connection very clearly and found it very powerful and profound.
But of course, now what we're seeing internationally is a lot of nationalism. And, you know, if you're saying the international community was much more accepting of a Dr. King than the United States.
Yeah.
I don't know that would be the case right now based on what we're hearing about what's happening internationally. Well, why do you think that is?
Yeah, probably not. I mean, King himself argued that national boundaries were somewhat artificial. I mean, he would have argued for lifting borders and certainly not building walls. He is a symbol and a powerful symbol to people fighting for freedom everywhere, I would say.
All right. Jason Sokol, professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and author of the book The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And to talk more about Dr. King's influence around the globe and here at home, we're joined by Khalil Muhammad from WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. He's a professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So how would you describe Martin Luther King Jr.'s international impact?
Well, I'd say that we have to think about the context of the Cold War and anti-colonial struggles, which are happening simultaneously to the civil rights movement. And in that sense, there is a tremendous community of transnational connections of people who self-identified, including in King's own language, as colored people of the world. The potential for what this broad international community of oftentimes majorities, populations in colonial nations in Africa, Asia, and Latin America were beginning to throw off what they would call the yoke of imperialism. They met in Indonesia in 1955. And so Dr. King's increasing influence as a result of early successes in the civil rights movement vis-a-vis Montgomery in 1955 through 1956 sent powerful signals around the world to other communities, other nations fighting against Western dominance that they could win.
You know, we just heard from Professor Jason Sokol, and he wrote about how Dr. King inspired social movements all over the globe. But, you know, considering the nationalism that we're seeing in so many countries now, especially here, how do we reconcile this situation with what it was like when King was so well regarded? How do you explain that?
Oh, it's a great question. Well, one way to think about it is to think about time. So Dr. King dies in 1968, which is in some ways precisely the moment of a kind of global precipice of often student-led social movements that upended many liberal democracies, certainly created moments of crises. And, of course, we know them very well here in the United States around the election of Richard Nixon and the great moment of the whole world is watching in Chicago. That was just one node of a larger global struggle that was playing out in Mexico City and Paris and many other places. So when Dr. King is literally on the eve of his death, when he writes in his final book, Where Do We Go From Here, he's writing about a backlash that he sees with regard to the real struggle of redressing the historical divestment of these communities of color, these black people in the United States, these colored people elsewhere, and that it would, in his own words, cost billions of rich nations. And so that kind of anticipation of a backlash to something more than just the promise of legal equality is in some ways the crisis of the resurgent white nationalist and alt-right movements that we see across liberal democracies in Western and, in some cases, younger democracies in Eastern Europe, that the very notion that people from other parts of the world, from Asia, from Africa, from the Middle East, are moving into these countries that claim to believe in a kind of liberal democracy where there are flows of labor that are the promises of citizenship have been roundly rejected because the resources would have to be redistributed in order to ensure a decent quality of life for these people.
And is that similar thinking when we talk about folks who are rising to positions of leadership? We talked about this morning's breakfast in Boston for Dr. King, where newly elected political leaders like Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley spoke about this changing face of political leadership. But you know, you've written about this before. How, in terms of how it pertains to President Obama, and you said, quote, no individual can bend the moral arc of our universe. What did you mean by that?
Well, I meant that we have mythologized Dr. King's influence. I know that you and many others have been to Dr. King celebrations, and the keynote of often of these celebrations is any one of you can make a difference, just like Dr. King could. But Dr. King was very clear in so much of his writing that it wasn't about what an individual could do. In fact, it was about what people would have to do together, and that the work of transformation was also the work of the state. So we have lost the actual king in exchange for a kind of mythology that gives us little more than just the representation of aspiration, of a dream, of the desire, or symbolic representation, as in the first black this or the first brown that or the first woman that. But Dr. King was clear. Systems had to be changed. He believed in fundamental transformation of our society.
And biggest system that you think would need to be changed before we would notice a more tangible effect here?
Oh, absolutely. We have to fundamentally change our economic system that is grinding and chewing up people not only here in the United States, regardless of their background, but also around the globe. So we know, I mean, this is not a question. We know that the global elite are absorbing resources from the productive capacity of people all over the world, which is unsustainable. And Dr. King was trying to call attention to that, as we well know, through his Poor People's March, but through a fundamental critique of the fact that we created money as the governing ethos of how to organize society rather than personhood. So we have to focus on caring about human beings, or what King would say, of people over profit.
What do you think Dr. King would urge this Congress, the most diverse Congress ever, what would he urge this Congress to try to accomplish?
Well, I think that he would stand, at least at this point, on the side of those who are resisting walls, those on the side who recognize refugees. He was a Christian minister. He recognized in the parables of the Gospels, as well as in the life of Jesus Christ, that there are, in fact, the least of these in our society that deserve the most of our attention. And so for that Dr. King, he would stand for those, whether they were big D Democrats, as in the party, or small D Democrats in the sense of those as human beings deserve a voice and a role in our society, and that nations and borders are not the way to define what human beings deserve.
You know, there was a controversial column in the Boston Globe over the weekend. The headline was, "As MLK foresaw, racism in America has been largely overcome." And in this column by Jeff Jacoby, the argument is that there are a bunch of statistics here that show that racism is less entrenched than it was in Dr. King's day. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I saw the column, and his evidence were all self-reported attitudes about intimacy and relationships, marriage, sending your kid to school with someone, living in the same neighborhood. It is the oldest and in some ways the most discredited benchmark for the problem of racism in America. Dr. King didn't talk as much about holding hands, black children and white children, so much as he talked about police brutality, so much as he talked about the franchise, so much as he talked about people being able to sit at a lunch counter but not be able to afford to eat there. So this is a complete distortion of the measure of racism in American society. Is that to say that these are not healthy signs of some measure of progress? Absolutely not. But to suggest that we can't claim racism as a problem in our society because of self-reported white attitudes about the potential of interracial marriage for their children is a distortion of the actual work that Dr. King left unfinished.
What do you think is a way that we might be able to measure whether the U.S. is making any progress?
Well, we would look at the same racial disparities that we see in terms of educational outcomes, in terms of who's likely to be punished for various crimes, including extreme sentences for violence, which were a product of deciding that black people in particular didn't deserve second chances. In other words, we would read the vast litany of racial disparities that most of us know pretty well. We are inundated with them, not as evidence of some kind of inherent inferiority of black people or of Mexican people, or that poor people in general are somehow broken at birth, or, as I often hear, have the unfortunate misfortune of growing up in a bad zip code, but in fact that we would see these as evidence of layers of disadvantage that are a function of actual policy and our politics. If we've learned nothing else in the age of the Trump administration, is that policy matters. The very fight over this new Congress and people like Ayanna Pressley is a fight over policy. And so we got into the situation where we see racial disparities all around us because of political choices and policy decisions. And so Dr. King, as he said in his own lifetime, would call our attention to the work of redressing those.
You know, you wrote a piece in 2017 that was published in the New York Times about racial barriers, and you quoted part of Martin Luther King's last book in 1967, where King warned that the civil rights movement was, quote, hobbled by delusion. He said the majority of white Americans consider themselves committed to racial justice, but unfortunately, this is a fantasy of self-deception. What do you think he meant by that, and why did you quote it in your piece in the New York Times in 2017?
Well, because Dr. King learned late in his life, as it turns out, that when he shifted from the successes, the legislative successes of the civil rights movement, to taking on the entrenched problem of poverty and racism and institutional racism in northern cities, he got a lot more depressed about what he was seeing. He was seeing a kind of entrenched white privilege and resistance to any fundamental change in the condition of black life that would not be solved by the kinds of laws that the civil rights movement had just taken credit for. And in that sense, he recognized that unless white people let go of their own sense of superiority or supremacy over African Americans or others in this country and around the world, that we would continue to see that people's lives would be unimportant to the nation's future, that his most aspirational notion of a beloved community would never be realized. And so he said, we have to face the facts of racism squarely and scientifically so that we don't continue to delude ourselves about what the problem actually is in America.
So what would you say has changed racially since then?
Yeah. Well, I would say that we've become a lot more prickly about being called racist.
That's for sure.
Certainly.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
Certainly true. Yeah. I would say that we can think of this as we've seen a lot of barriers fall, which is the, kind of the point of that piece. We've seen a lot of barriers fall, and of course the White House being the most coveted of them all. And so we have to take stock of that. Yes, we have a new black police chief in Boston, first time in history. That's something to celebrate. And therefore, we can talk about the numbers of African-Americans have moved into levels of middle and senior management. Although the numbers are fairly stagnant, they still represent significant change from 50 years ago when Dr. King was still around. So almost in every aspect of American society and life, we can see some measure of progress in terms of the numbers of black people who are in those positions and to some degree the way that the economic pie has been distributed, particularly among affluent Americans, because the truth is, and here I'll shift ground, that poverty has grown for poor people and wages have stagnated for poor people no matter what color you are, what background you have. And that problem is most acutely felt for African Americans because they carry the weight of their historical disadvantage and new forms of disadvantage. Mm. So it is not just a mixed story, it is an unbalanced story, meaning that there has been progress for a smaller number at the top and retrogression. We have receded for a big number at the bottom. The last example, and I won't belabor the point, is the criminal justice system was nothing like it was in 1968 as it is in 2018. It is a behemoth. It is the most largest system of unfreedom that the world has ever known in terms of a criminal justice system, and black people have borne the brunt of that in ways that we are still discovering.
All right. Khalil Muhammad, professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.